Hello and welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. This is the final episode for our Cloud Native Month in support for KubeCon and Cloud Native Con happening next month in Valencia, Spain. Today we had Or Azazar talking about what is the difference between a managed Kubernetes environment as well as a self-hosted Kubernetes environment. What is the difference between a EKS, AKS, GKE, and all the different kinds of managed Kubernetes environments that exist. We also spoke about when do you really need to have a CSPM tool or continue using open source when managing Kubernetes clusters, or how do you start talking about Kubernetes security when you are a startup all the way to scaling on to becoming a company which has multiple Kubernetes clusters. This was one of the most requested topics in terms of clarifying what's the difference between a Kubernetes environment which is self-hosted versus that is hosted by AWS, Google Cloud, or Azure. As always, if you find value from this episode, please feel free to share this with someone who's probably looking at understanding Kubernetes security more from a managed cloud service provider perspective. Also, while you're there, feel free to drop us a review or rating as it helps us find more people that we can help out. And it also helps guests realize how much value they can get by being part of Cloud Security Podcast as a guest over here. I hope you enjoyed the episode and I will see you with the next month's theme of Azure security. Yes, we're talking about Azure security for a whole month and I'm looking forward to our first conversation this week, coming weekend. I will talk to you on the episode. Until then, enjoy the week and talk to you over the weekend. Peace. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and your journey to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Or. I'm 35 years old, currently the CTO and the co-founder at Lightspan, a cloud security startup from Israel. And I think a bit differently from a lot of other Israeli cybersecurity entrepreneurs, I wasn't, you know, in the intelligence or A200. My military service was a bit different. I was in the Navy, was a submariner. Nothing close to technology, so that's where I started. And after 4.5 years, I think I sort of left and then started my journey inside, you know, the cybersecurity technology, starting from really early days in NOC engineering and IT, and quickly transitioned into security field, really by accident. Just, you know, someone just picked me. My manager said, like, you know, you should start handling our firewalls, and then from there. I quickly did lots of roles in the Israeli security agency for cybersecurity, sort of 8 years, lead few teams from developing internal security solution, then developing more of embedded security stuff. Then after 8 years, I left and joined an Israeli automotive cybersecurity company. That's where I met Vladi, my partner, he's the CEO today. Doing lots of projects, mainly for connected car platforms. So it's like the cloud side of connected vehicles. And after a year, I both left and started Lightspan.
And out of curiosity, considering this is Cloud Native Month, and we kind of have, it's funny, we were just offline talking about Kubernetes and the popularity Kubernetes has. Just to level the playing field for people, what is Kubernetes for you? And why do you see it's getting so popular? What are people using it for?
Yeah, so I think maybe for me today, it's like the standard for running maybe workloads in the cloud today. I would be curious, you know, a bit cautious about this because, you know, others are maybe on serverless environments or still on old legacy workloads. But I think today that's the most common standard to run workloads in the cloud, I would say. Generally, for everyone starting today, so Kubernetes is a container orchestration platform, I would say. Mm-hmm. You can think of it as a set of controllers and services that orchestrate and sort of automates the entire operation and of the platform and the infrastructure tasks that we were used to do by ourselves in the past or running scripts that does this. So, for example, auto-scaling and auto-healing, things that we were, you know, used to take care of our own, is taking care of automatically today in Kubernetes, where we have seamless deployments of our applications, automatic load balancing and discovery for our services. I think also in terms of configuration, so a really easy way to manage our config and secrets for our applications, everything sort of built in right there in Kubernetes. And everything could also be sort of declared right from the beginning as part of the infrastructure. So we're not just declaring how our application is running, but where we store our configurations and how it's scaled and how it's replicated and what storage does it use. So everything sort of declared in one easy YAML file. Everything, I think, in Kubernetes is sort of managed by an API that is running in the control plane. So we have the control plane in Kubernetes, and we have the workers, which are running our workloads. And the control plane is where all the controllers and the services are running to manage the workloads and our applications.
Mm-hmm.
And those workloads are running on worker nodes, which is, those are actually the virtual machines or the servers that are hosting all our applications. Every application is called the pod, which can hold one or more containers. So for example, if my web application can include like a WordPress container and a MySQL container, then combining them together to an application would be called a pod. And that can be deployed on each worker or can be deployed on one of them. Depends on the deployment type. Yeah.
So it's almost like a orchestration of a predefined application is another way to define it, but using containers and pods and stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
And what's the difference between the whole cloud-managed Kubernetes? And a lot of people seem to have gone down the traditional path of, we're going to do a self-managed one. Why did people go down the self-managed path in the first place? Why not just go for cloud-managed? So what's the difference, first of all?
So the difference first is, on a managed Kubernetes, basically the cloud service provider has another layer of abstraction, while the entire control plane is managed by the cloud service provider. So we don't really have access to the control plane. We can communicate with it, we can configure it, but basically running by the cloud service provider. And it saves us a lot of time for deploying the cloud, the control plane, and configuring it from this first place.
Yeah.
I think today, within a few clicks, you can get a Kubernetes cluster running on every cloud service provider, set with, you know, predefined rules and versions and security patches and rolling updates, whatever we need. While on a self-managed, you have to do everything by ourselves. And that's tough. I mean, that's tough. For people that started with Kubernetes years ago, they were doing this by themselves, became as mature as it is today on cloud service providers. And it's tough. I mean, it takes a lot of DevOps effort and a lot of work to build this and maintain this efficiently. So I would say those are the main differences.
Right. Sounds like cloud management should have been the first preference for a lot of people, or should be the first preference for a lot of people at the moment. Does the shared responsibility kind of change in what used to be the traditional Kubernetes versus what the cloud managed version is?
Yeah, it definitely changed. I would say that I think today for most consumers, a managed Kubernetes has way more advantages. Than, you know, managing the cluster by ourselves. As the cloud, you know, service providers are more mature in this set of features they provide and the stability, the shared responsibility in this case is sort of giving them another piece of the infrastructure to manage. So it's not just the underlying infrastructure, but also part of the Kubernetes infrastructure, which is the control plane. So depends on the different vendors, but some of them are already updating, you know, part of the nodes and doing some security patches for us, and they are managing the entire control plane. So, you know, if your control plane is now crashing or the API, they have those automated ways of, you know, restarting it and making sure it's more resilient, which takes more responsibility to them.
So if the managed services make sense, then why is there a gap here? Is there much difference between EKS and AKS and GKE and stuff? What's the obvious one or two differences that you see straight away between the Kubernetes offering?
So I would say that, I mean, it's hard to really pinpoint like very, you know, specific ones, but I think, you know, since Kubernetes started from Google, their offering is more mature today. Like GKE is, I think, more mature than the others. And I don't see a big gaps between, I mean, them. 80%, let's say, of the requirements today would probably be the same. GKE is super easy to deploy, very friendly to manage. It has automatic upgrades for both the control plane and the worker nodes. Rather than on EKS, you are, let's say EKS, it's the AWS version of it. You still have to do the worker nodes updates by yourself. You know, it doesn't done automatically.
So, and between AKS, Azure version?
So AKS have I think today has more native integrations with Azure policies or Active Directory. So if you're coming from sort of an Azure shop and more IT led, where you came from the on-prem with everything based on Active Directory, that's more seamless. It's like out of the box, you get everything based on Active Directory, super easy. If that's where you started your journey to Kubernetes, like going from on-prem workloads into the cloud and Azure, that's your shop, and everything is based on Azure policies or Active Directory. That's definitely there.
So it sounds like obviously people may still have to make a choice between, hey, whether I do want to go for the most updated GKE version or manage my updates on Amazon, to what you were saying, or maybe come from an IT push. How does that scale in terms of, say, if I start today on EKS, and I'm assuming, I don't think you would have noticed a pattern between this, more of GKE versus more of AKS or more of EKS, but is there a pattern of adoption that you've noticed so far in terms of one over the other?
So at least I see a lot of movements towards GKE and EKS today. That's what at least I see in the market. And I think specifically some reasons are because, security is taken care of by the CS cloud service providers in this case. That's part of the motion and the stuff that we're seeing. I think developers more oriented, if you're in AWS, then EKS, of course, that's the easy. And if you need more, I think, integrations to other services in the clouds, so AWS is more rich there. But if most of your, let's say, ecosystem for your applications is everything running Kubernetes, then I guess GKE would be also an amazing choice there, where you don't need lots of external stuff in the cloud service.
All right. So I guess because I'm imagining a typical build, how when people deploy Kubernetes, they talk about, hey, I need to do etcd, I need to configure my API server, I need to do, 10 different things before. To what you were saying, the state is predefined for exactly what you want, and the Kubernetes cluster is managed by the admin. In terms of applications that are being built, would they be, I think from a security perspective, we've got a lot of security architects who may be listening to this as well. From their perspective, what are they looking for in those kind of builds from a security perspective? What do you think is already covered, but what is not covered specifically that they should be looking out for?
So I don't think a lot is covered. I'll be, honestly here. There's a lot of predefined configurations and rules where you can set, but I would say, for startups or, anyone that secures, Kubernetes clusters from the beginning, take the time for planning it, test the different tools you want to use. And in this case, there's a great open source and checklist that Jonathan Rao, our CISO, did for deploying a secure EKS. This is the one we're using and other companies are using, which just turns on by default, encryption at rest and logging for all the API in Kubernetes, and also installs by default, Falco, which is a great runtime protection, and other rules. You don't have to use this also to deploy your EKS clusters or just for EKS, but you can use this checklist also when you are deploying Kubernetes, even on Google Cloud or Azure, to just see that's the basic stuff that I need, my Kubernetes cluster to have when I'm deploying it in terms of security. So I think that's a great reference to use when doing this. Great resource, even just as a checklist. On our GitHub, you can see this. It's called ECE, a great project. That would be the basic I would start off with.
With cloud native one, cloud managed Kubernetes.
Yeah. It's currently for EKS. We plan to do support for Azure and GCP in the future, but the checklist there is valid for all of them. Yeah.
So maybe another way to put this is, I've got a question here from David as well. When securing Kubernetes clusters, what are the pros and cons of choosing the cloud platform native security policy management versus a third-party CSPM tool?
Okay, so I think there's, in terms of, the security policy management, I haven't seen many great security tools. Usually it's just, a checklist, whether it's, CIS benchmark or running basic posture stuff, which is okay, but it doesn't cover a lot of stuff. It doesn't cover the connectivity between the Kubernetes cluster to the infrastructure side, like For example, do I have an over-permissive IAM roles attached to my pods? Are my hosts running in a secure way? And a lot of CSPMs today are able to, like mostly next generation CSPMs, but are able to correlate issues that are between those two layers, and it's super important because just looking on Kubernetes, it's not enough today. This is one thing. The second is, I would say, the ability to continuously write your own policies and sort of taking them into the workflow for your organization. So from the platform, the third-party CSPM, right into a Jira ticket or ServiceNow or any whatever the workflow is, and you know, integrating with different API and also with different, I would say, security features in the product. So the ability to correlate posture management issues within Kubernetes with the vulnerabilities of running applications. That's super important. Otherwise, you can get tons of alerts without context. You know, we mentioned the context a bit earlier, but that's part of it. And the ability for third-party security to correlate, you know, vulnerabilities with the posture management and security policies and the exposure of the entire infrastructure is super critical, for at least from my opinion in this case.
Yeah, I think probably one more thing to add there is also a scale of it as well, right? Because I think a lot of examples that I hear quite often is the fact that if you have one Kubernetes, like, I don't know, one Kubernetes cluster that you're managing, the policies and the policy management within a cloud provider is probably enough. But the moment you start having multiple Kubernetes clusters and you start scaling that, and I think nowadays the challenge of Kubernetes clusters is not enough to say, I only have one Kubernetes cluster. I may have 20 Kubernetes clusters running in my AWS account, another 5 in GKR from in Google Cloud. How do I manage all of them together? I think that's kind of where at least I have been able to personally find value in the whole third-party CSPM space, because it's like Amazon is never going to, at least at the moment, I don't know if they might announce it, reinforce or reinvent. They don't have like a single layer to manage all of it, at least at their end. But I think, or maybe, I don't know if GKE does that. I haven't done much work in GKE, but I think that's kind of where I definitely find that shines. He's got a follow-up as well. What are your thoughts on policy as code?
So I think it's a great addition to it. I think that, you know, at least we are also using OPA, the Open Policy Agent, by ourselves. That's awesome. Whether if you're using it as a sort of a passive, like detecting issues before they're being deployed or you're over your infrastructure as code, or you're using this as an admission controller in Kubernetes to block certain things from happening before, you know, they're running in Kubernetes. So we're definitely embracing this. And you mentioned, you know, the scale. So at least today in our company, we have, I think, 5 or 6 different Kubernetes clusters. And it's easier for us. And, you know, we're using OPA constantly as a policy of code to enforce different stuff. And we're allowing even others to write their own policies.
Yeah,
and it's super helpful. And I think also policies code is really scalable because you can route your policy once and apply this to clusters running, whether it's AWS, Google Cloud, or Azure, and it should be the same while they're treating Kubernetes assets the same.
Ah, sweet. Thanks for sharing that. Hopefully that answered your question, David, but feel free to ask a follow-up, man. Like, thanks for that. Great. So continuing with this then, I think maybe it's a good segue into the next question that I wanted to ask as well. We spoke about the difference between the different cloud-provided Kubernetes clusters and how our responsibility kind of changes between them. For a startup that may be listening to this as well, I think we spoke about from a security perspective, they need to think about some of the basic foundational pieces still, like you mentioned overtly permissive IAM role in an EKS context, something similar in GKE. From an application that may just be one cluster and maybe another startup like yours, I guess, you know, like at Lightspin was, they're trying to build this. What do you see as some of the security components for Kubernetes that they should be looking at closely to manage them? Is any thoughts on that so they can kind of learn from what you guys may have learned as well?
Yeah, definitely. So I think in this case, I would, you know, go and not just, you know, click the next when deploying a new Kubernetes cluster, but just looking on the documentation really and see what are all those boxes when you usually don't tick or the cloud service provider doesn't tick for you. We make sure, at least when we started our journey, to make sure on day one, all the secrets that our application uses is in a vault, is, you know, stored somewhere else, and everything is declared from the beginning. We defined everything as an infrastructure as code in our place. It's like, hey, we have Helm files that deploys the applications, and we have Terraform that deploys the cluster itself. And it's very helpful because whether you're going to touch your security, you know, next phase more carefully, you can audit everything in one place. And if you have, you know, a drift with between what you have in infrastructure as code and the manual stuff that you did, then putting security together is going to be much more harder. Although it seems odd to enable all the logging in the first place, I would recommend doing this because you never know when, you know, there's going to be an incident or you have to investigate something and then you need the logs and then you would say, oh, why I didn't enable this? So there's a cost to this, of course, but I would enable this in the first place and even choose the way the nodes are running, like in this case, to make it on the most secure way. And also everything that relates to identity, the easiest part, and I guess you know this also, is giving an admin for everyone. Yeah, you need this, just be an admin. And that's hard. I know managing also role-based access control in Kubernetes is a bit tough, but those are the stuff that I would invest in first place that would save a lot of time when doing auditing or security or pen testing or even when connecting your first CSPM or KSPM, whether it's Kubernetes, to and then get tons of findings. So those are the stuff that I would start in the beginning. It's not, you know, going into runtime protection in the beginning or, you know, CV scanning for everything and stuff like this, but should make things more easier in the future.
And to your point then, as they may be starting to scale and they would have heard what you've said, some people may have already followed the path as well. And they've gone, okay, I've made sure not everyone is a root user, not everyone is an admin. I have done the basic sanity pieces of, right, at least I'm managing one cluster of my Kubernetes in the deployment. What happens when you start scaling to 2, 3, 4? Like, how does security scale? Because as you kind of mentioned something really interesting about turning on logging as well. That's probably, I imagine the scale of it changes as you kind of grow. So what do you see would change from a security perspective when you scale from multiple clusters, I guess? What were the challenges that you came across?
So centralized logging, as you mentioned. So in the beginning, of course, you use the native cloud service. If you use the cloud service provider managed Kubernetes, then everything is like on its own logging place, whether it's, you know,
CloudWatch or one of those.
CloudWatch or, you know, the application insights in Azure. So then putting everything on a centralized place is something important, I think. Second phase is exactly, I think, what Dave asked about is about, you know, policies code. So great, we have all the clusters, but if we want to prevent more advanced things from happening in our production, or at least get insights about what's currently running in production, so having admission controllers it would allow us to see what's going inside, you know, runtime. Mm-hmm. What issues do we have, or what sort of authorization workflows we have that might, you know, affect our clusters? That's, I guess, the interesting part. And also going inside network policies. So we haven't touched network policies before because I think that it's still not very mature in Kubernetes to manage this by your own if you're not running any service mesh or any kind of higher abstraction level for networking. But then this would be the place to start, you know, hardening your network policies and make sure not every pod can communicate with everyone. It's like starting making things more strict. This would probably be the next things I would tackle when starting scaling Kubernetes. So like one place to store all my policies in code and make sure they're enforced on the different clusters. Make sure I have a centralized logging and then making sure whether I choose the proper networking solution or service mesh that I have the policies also as part of my policies code for the networking for the different environments, I guess. You know, dev and test are different sometimes from production.
Yeah. And to your point then, as you kind of scale from being a one cluster company to maybe 3 and 4 cluster or maybe even larger, you may be, okay, if logging is done by CloudWatch or whatever the equivalent is in the cloud managed provider. Do you see, I guess from a challenge perspective, would there be like, I've done the right things, I've deployed it, centralized it, putting it in a central place. I'm assuming you meant some kind of a seam, or is there a better way? I feel like there's a lot of data these days. It's like a security data lake, or what's your thoughts there on the whole seam piece as well. Where are you centralizing this?
So in the beginning, I guess, you know, we use also, you know, we use the same observability platform we use for the developers with all the logins, same as for SIEM in the moment.
Yeah.
But we are looking on jumping straight from our current monitoring, application monitoring and observability directly into security data. Like that's where Jonathan, our CISO, is pushing, taking all the data into there and from there working on the data. So it's a different, you know, aspect to it. It's a different angle to it. It requires more data engineering skills, but I think there's enough tools today and solutions to support this. But this is where we are. This is where we are targeting or aiming our efforts to. So just directly from using the built-in observability and application monitoring tools for logging directly into security data. Like, I think it's, no, I wouldn't say it's like the next generation SIEM for it, but it's definitely a place where we think security engineers should be in. That's the place where you can really benefit from security. So that's my take on this. It's, you know, still early for us, even on this kind of, you know, where we're thinking of this, but
yeah. Well, I think it's funny because we had someone from Snowflake, Omar, ages ago, talk about secure data lake and how a lot of the big people, I guess the Netflix of the world, they all have data engineers in the security team as well, because they all realize ultimately it comes down to the data. It doesn't really matter. And talking about data from a monitoring perspective as well, what are some of the scenarios that people are really looking for in Kubernetes? Is there like a CIS benchmark or what are they trying to monitor? Because I think you kind of mentioned in the beginning about the context for why is it relevant or why is CVE relevant and all of this. Does the CVE has context in Kubernetes? I guess it's still a container running, so you probably still have a CVE required at that point in time.
Yeah, so first, I mean, the monitoring, so yeah, a lot of people are looking for, you know, the basics, CIS benchmark, where's my issue, who's privileged, who has access, you know, root admins, which containers are running with over-permissive access or networking access. And on top of it, the idea of context is that, you know, it's easy today, like if you connect any vulnerability management or scanning tool to most of the running containers today, you would get thousands of CVEs. And you can't really track by your own which of my containers run on each pod and which pod is public to the internet. It's hard. I mean, like you would get thousands of alerts or, you know, those tons of YAMLs to declare and go through. And when asking the question of, let's say, do I have an exploitable CVE or a CVE which is exposed on a port, which is also part of my ingress controller, I mean, the load balancer, in Kubernetes, and this is also exposed by my cloud service provider to the internet on an external load balancer, then this is where the most interesting part is happening. And this really is where you would need your first monitoring in terms of, you know, how do I reduce the attack surface on my Kubernetes cluster? Just running vulnerability scan would trigger tons of alerts. Just running benchmarks and, you know, the default policies would probably get a lot of alerts, even by the default pods running by the cloud service provider. So every managed Kubernetes has its own pods and containers that the cloud service providers is pushing agents for doing his internal stuff. And those sometimes create alerts by itself.
All right.
Yeah. I can tell you that when we're running, you know, Falco by default on all the cloud service providers, you would see Falco triggering tons of alerts on all the default ones, and this is stuff that when we are starting to monitor and looking on clusters are things that we should exclude, things with maybe we should be aware of the risk, because sometimes we think that the cloud service provider is, you know, safe and we know it's not. So those are the stuff we're also looking to monitor besides this.
Right. So to your point then, I agree with you on the fact that over the past few months of people discovering, I think Lightspin also had a few discoveries as well within the AWS space as well. So I think I definitely agree on the fact that there's definitely holes left unpatched on cloud service providers that people are starting to recognize more often now. Somehow it seems like the last few months, everyone's kind of found at least one in each one of those. So maybe another way to ask this question is also the fact that, okay, I've done a cloud-managed Kubernetes cluster to what you said. If I have one, I'm making sure that at least logging is there so I can make sure that I see what needs to be done. If I'm scaling out, I start doing policy as code. where whether it's OPA or some other way, you mentioned service mesh as well. Do you reckon for network policy, is service, some kind of a service mesh actually a requirement, or does the basic network policy provided by the cloud managed provider is enough in a Kubernetes cluster, or it would not have?
So it should be enough for the beginning, the basic network policies. Like, it's sort of, you know, configuring a network firewall rules, pretty the same, has some limitations there for the nine certain rules, but should be enough for the basics. But on large scale clusters with lots of applications where you're not sure which communicating with each, then service mesh is really helpful in this case. And then you can just, you know, enforce your network policies right there, much easier in this case. Yeah.
And to your point, what about the team skill set at this point in time as well? Because it already sounds like the team needs to know cloud, they need to know Kubernetes, they also need to know OPA, policy code. Like, what kind of skill sets are people looking for in their teams just to manage Kubernetes security?
Wow. Yeah, that's tough. So I would say that, you know, looking on Kubernetes, it's like an entire cloud within your cloud, okay? It's sort of where it goes, huge ecosystem, lots of startups doing all different types where you can see on the cloud, in the same as Kubernetes, like storage solutions and encryption solutions and service mesh and, you know, security, everything. So I think I would start by, you know, first, the Kubernetes documentation is really awesome. There's lots of snippets and examples of how to run stuff. And I would recommend also people starting by building and breaking their own Kubernetes clusters. That's great. I mean, I've built a few or breakthrough. I mean, that's where you really learn, and starting also with the self-managed, not the...
Oh, right.
Because that, like, otherwise you won't have the understanding of how the control plane runs, what's run there, how the API is managed, how it's configured. On most, I think, managed Kubernetes clusters, or maybe everyone today, you can't really get the, let's say, the properties of the command line running the API server. And that's an issue, because, like, you can't really understand all the parameters and what's possible and whatnot. And when you're doing this by yourself, you'll get lots of information about how it really runs on the cloud service provider side. So I would say documentation, and starting with, you know, your own Kubernetes cluster. Kubs is a really great way to start with. And then I would go, you know, with the most common patterns for using Kubernetes today. And once you get this in place, then learning, you know, Terraform and Helm for infrastructure as code, OPA for policies code are awesome. There are some also great open source projects like Gatekeeper for OPA, which allows us to, you know, enforce part of the policies that we want. So it's great to do this. Lots of demos and walkthroughs of those kind of stuff. There's lots of open sources where you can learn about, you know, different types of patterns for Kubernetes.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, that's how we, you know, started our journey there.
Oh, perfect. No, thanks for sharing that, man. I appreciate that. Thank you for listening to that episode of Cloud Security Podcast. If you found some new information from that episode, we would appreciate if you share it with others. Share it with us as well if you have any good feedback or good learnings from the episode. We are on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you don't find us there, you can always go on our website, www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv, to listen to the latest episode. We appreciate your support in helping us grow. It helps us bring more guests. It helps us support the channel. So really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time, and talk to you on the next episode.